Welcome to Vital Signs. I'm your host, Jen Godet, and we are here to talk all about our greatest asset, our health. You're in for a treat today. I have heard, you have written, I have listened. Mental health, mental well-being is on everyone's hearts, on everyone's minds. So we have a special treat for you today. Addiction is not a dead end. It's a doorway. After everyone asking about this topic, I've been blessed to have Deborah Crystal, founder and CEO of Epigenetic Scan, here to share her journey, to show us how hitting rock bottom can uncover your true purpose and change lives far beyond your own. Deborah, welcome back to the studio.
Thank you, Jen. So happy to be here.
Listen, Deborah, you've built a transformative health tech company, but before all that, you were facing addiction. Can you talk to us a little bit about your story? What was your low point and what shifted that trajectory?
Absolutely. Yeah, 9 years ago, it's been a little over 9 years. And I remember I was living in a house that I couldn't pay for. And I had two roommates. And there was a warrant out for my arrest. And I came to that point, and it brought me to my knees. You know, I realized I wasn't afraid of dying. I was really afraid of living. I was broken. I was exhausted. And I was lying on the floor of a dirty room with a warrant out for my arrest. So something in me said, this needs to change. And it did. I mean, I found out the warrant was because of, you know, a couple, it was due to DUIs as to why I was, you know, served a couple of different sentences at different points in my life. And there, I didn't have anything. I was homeless for many years, so I didn't have that. So they needed me to pay some court fees, and I didn't have the money. So what did I do? I reached out to my parents, and they came through, and they paid that off. And I said, I'll do it, and I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to get help. I made that promise. And it wasn't for them. It was honestly, it was for me at that time. And I'll never forget, you know, wheeling into on a wheelchair into a treatment center in Palm Beach, Florida on March 6, 2016, wearing these like snooky leopard slippers. But I haven't touched a drug or a drink since. And I'm here today, and I'm living an amazing, abundant life.
Well, you know, many people watching may be experiencing this, either themselves or a family member. They might be in survival mode. How did you move from that moment? Getting help is a huge decision. And there's a lot of people who go in and out of that revolving door. But you made a choice, because from that moment, you shifted from surviving to thriving. And eventually you built a mission-based business. Like, how did you shift that? Was it a mindset shift? Like, what was it that shifted you from, hey, I need to do this because I need to survive, to I'm actually going to thrive. This is going to catapult me. I'm going to use this to catapult me to the next level.
Absolutely. I honestly didn't know what I didn't know. I mean, at that time, I was delusional, you know, from all the drugs, everything that I did at that point. For many years of 15 years of addiction, I was able to, some of those years, kind of do my thing, get good grades. I made, you know, I got all A's in my bachelor's, and I continued, you know, on that journey. But I overdosed 3 times. I was pronounced actually dead once. I stopped breathing and I woke up, and they told my mom like that I was, you know, she didn't make it. And I woke up to all these like different monitors laying there with my ex-boyfriend and boyfriend looking over me, with my aunt looking over me. And all I said was like, when can I leave? Like, I want to get out of here. You know, I didn't understand. And that was 2009. And I went many years after that out doing even more damage to myself. And you would think that would wake me up. I did get Baker Acted and had to go to Massachusetts and stay with my family and do a detox at that time. But I did not do it for me. That was the main thing. I did it because my parents said if I didn't, then they would take this away. Or if I didn't do it, you know, it was the only option, but I still did not believe I had a problem. And that's the scary thing. So what happened for me is, you start small. When I made that decision, when I was laying on that floor in that like weird, house, roommates, that I barely remember, and I was dating a guy like twice my age, and I look at my life then, and once I made a decision, like, hey, I'm gonna go ahead and I'm gonna take that next step. I'm gonna do what I need to do because this is no longer working for me. It just came to me at rock bottom right then and there, looking at this room full of clothes, laying there, just surrendering. I was like 80 pounds, and save my life. So you got to start with that decision. Start small. I had to keep that promise to myself, and I wanted to have a new life. And I knew having that life, there was a path towards it because I knew other people did it before. So I went ahead and I went into that treatment center, even though I was on a wheelchair and it was hard to even eat or do anything. I had a babysitter to watch me every night, like in the room, because it was that bad. But I just went through and I went through it. And then finally, I admitted that I'm an alcoholic and addict. And it came to that point that I, got into that stage. And it was very powerful for me. And I cried and I mourned, the losses and trauma that I've been through. And it's still an ongoing journey, but you got to take that first step, and I prayed in a higher power. For me, it's God. And then just one day at a time, honestly, one second at a time, and knowing that there are promises, there are people that have done it before you, and we're here to create. So we can do anything. We're powerful beings.
And I hear that. I feel that viscerally. And I'm going to ask the next question because it sounds like, you had hope and you were able to grasp onto that hope, even in, I mean, the darkest hour, the darkest days. So for everybody who's watching, what does hope look like, or what that could hope look like for them if they're still in that darkness? Like, what does that look like, and how can they begin to move forward?
Yeah, I mean, that's my message, is that there is hope. I mean, if I can do it, I promise you, that you can do it too, no matter what, no matter where you're at this moment in time, no matter what has happened in your past, there is something greater on the other side. And just trusting that and understanding that everything that you have done during your time, whether it's some type of addiction, that's an obsession, right? When you're addicted to something, that's an obsession. And obsession is really, it's neutral, right? It can really destroy, or it can actually create. So the key is how you channel it. And so what I did is I use that as a superpower. And it taught me, things that you could not learn in business school or anywhere else. You had to learn it through going through it, and rewiring your brain and really taking those steps, because everything you want is on the other side of discomfort. Sobriety, fitness, truth, entrepreneurship, and just being willing to take that first step. I promise you, little by little, the pieces will come together. You will, if you believe, and if you make that decision, you will be brought people into your life, circumstances, all these divine things that will come into your life, like it did for me in creating epigenetic scan.
And so you say trauma, healing, and purpose are all connected. We've talked about this on the show before. What did you learn about yourself through this process that others can apply to their own journey, and maybe their own recovery? Give me that gem, that real big gem that you learned by going through it and forging through the fire.
Yeah, absolutely. So what seemed like major, setbacks were actually really catalysts for transformation. Every problem, even as I see it today, is really an invitation from life to transform, to evolve, to really upgrade ourselves. And I'm just grateful for this gift because I had to surrender. And I surrendered to my, higher power, as I said, because I knew that they have way better plans for me than I ever have for myself, right? That was no life I was living. Like, I couldn't fool myself anymore. It wasn't. So, but trauma teaches you how to survive. But really, healing, what that does is that teaches you how to live. And when you heal, you gain compassion, you gain grit and wisdom that, like I said, you couldn't have learned any other way. And that's your superpower. I would not trade my past, any part of it, because it gave me depth and I know I can now use to really help others rise.
Oh, I love that. You're not broken, you're breaking through. Trauma teaches survival, and healing teaches you how to live. Those are beautiful words. We are going to leave you with that. We do have to take a brief break, but when we return, we're going to dive into our next powerful topic. And really, it's how, Deborah, you have helped through this. Now you're helping women prioritize their health, because when women prioritize their health, everyone wins. Too often, we're last on our own list. How do we shift that narrative after these important messages? When women put their health last, the whole system suffers. But when we lead with well-being, everyone rises with us. Let's rewrite the story from guilt to empowered. Deborah, your story before the break showed us what it meant to rise from really rock bottom in the depths. But now you're showing women how to rise by choice instead of crisis. Let's talk a little bit about what you're seeing over and over again. We care for everyone, but we don't take care of ourselves. Why is this still the norm, and what is that costing us?
Well, for so long, I believe women were really expected to put themselves last. And I believe, that narrative is finally shifting in many ways. I think it's culture as well. And I thank God that it is shifting because I know it does linger in a lot of homes and in a lot of habits. As well, because women were taught to be the, stay-at-home mom, cook, clean, do all these things, and seen in a different way compared to a man. But now I'm seeing women rise, lead, and really claim their space. And because if you don't, and if that inner script in yourself says, everybody else comes first, and I'm gonna do everything for somebody else. Well, the cost of that is burnout, resentment, and preventable illness. So when a woman abandons herself, everybody loses, and the cost is massive.
I couldn't agree more. I come from healthcare, and it's a common story, especially for females who are in the healthcare industry, because it's an even bigger pressure for us to take care of everyone else on top of our families. And you're absolutely right. We put self-care at the bottom of the list, and it just doesn't happen. And no one gets the best of us. So really, self-care isn't selfish. It's a leadership strategy. And whether you're an entrepreneur or a mom or whatever you are in life, we as women are leaders in our community. So, Deborah, what does that look like practically, especially for busy moms, professionals, caregivers? What does self-care look like? How do we begin to step in and empower ourselves to take that extra step and take care of our health and our physical, mental, emotional needs?
So important. The instruction to put your own oxygen mask on first in an airplane emergency really is a metaphor for prioritizing self-care and self-preservation. You put on that mask first, right? Same in life, and it's about putting yourself first. And I'm not saying doing it in like a selfish, narcissistic way. It's not about that. It's even, the opposite. That's love, right? That is, it's about saying no without guilt. It's about creating a sacred moment in your day. Maybe it's 10 minutes in your closet before the kids wake up, right? To breathe, to reflect, and really to remember who you are at the core. I mean, I do every morning. And I've been doing this now even before my children, were born. I have a 4-year-old, but I started this about 5 years ago, the miracle morning. And I just made a commitment. I started with maybe 10 minutes, setting my alarm for maybe 6:15, just a little bit earlier. And I would do some affirmations and visualize a life that God placed on your heart. And what it looks like to lead with that. Because when you lead yourself well, others will follow. So doing that has been a game changer. I do that consistently. And then asking for help, as well. You've got to ask. People are there. There's so much support. People are they're good humans, out there. There's a lot of people, that can help you. And then you're going to show your kids, your mom is out there. What true wellness looks like. They're watching you more than we even know. My daughter was lifting weights with me this morning. So it was cute.
That's awesome. And you're so right, especially when we are mothers, grandmothers, children watch what we do. They do as we do, not as we say. So many times, when we're putting ourselves on the back burner, we're saying for them to do something, but they're actually picking up our own guilt, our own limiting beliefs, actually, is what I would call them. So it really is critical, especially if you have children, grandchildren. Today's the day to take care of yourself, because by modeling that and by setting boundaries, they learn healthy boundaries as well. So talk to me a little bit about how, what you're doing, health education, learning, taking those steps, how does that shift a woman's sense of control, her confidence, and her clarity, not just in our bodies, but also in our lives?
Absolutely. So, knowledge, right? Knowledge gives you that control. When we understand our biology, our stress, our inflammation, and those areas in our life by tracking them and knowing where we started by having the data, that is clarity. And it's not about, the weight per se or the labs. It's about having something that you can look at and be able to track and understand and knowing what works for your body so that you can show up fully, in your life and as your best self. So that's what I would definitely say is so huge for me every single day is being able to track and know and then improve upon that and feel that difference.
I couldn't agree more. Now, knowledge is power, and tracking trends is so important, because sometimes we just don't know what it is that's got us feeling a certain way, or not performing our best, or showing up our best selves. So when we have something and we're measured, what gets measured gets managed. And when we're watching the trends, we're able to make those little tweaks that really make a big impact. So what have you found are the most empowering resources or tools that women can access right now so that they can reclaim their health, empower themselves to really dive into that self-care, for themselves?
As I was saying, starting with data, right? So where are you going to get that? A watch, finding tracking your steps, knowing specific metrics so that you can see where you're at and improve along the way. And also using technology to measure inflammation and antioxidants in your body. Inflammation is the root of every single disease out there. We don't want that in our body, so it's better to know than to wait, right? We've talked about that before on other episodes. So knowing where you're at, understanding it, and then taking action on that, because most people overestimate, what they can do in a year, but they underestimate what they can do in a day. And so you really want to put yourself on the calendar. Write your name down. You have an appointment with yourself. Whatever that looks like for you, but you got to be intentional. You don't need to flip your whole life upside down, but small seeds produce big harvest. So you got to water it. and it grows. No farmer plants one seed and expects it to grow tomorrow. So know that it's about consistency. Same in my journey in recovery. Things didn't happen overnight. It's a journey, and I've grown, and I'm unrecognizable from where I began in every possible way. And I'm just so excited to see, what the future looks like, because I know it's going to get better and better because I've trained my mind to see that and to see the good. And I've changed my core beliefs about who I am. So just doing that, it takes work. Is it worth it? 100%, because what else are you going to do? We have this one magical life right here, and it happens fast. But you're not doing it alone. You have a community, and you have resources like Now Media, TV, where you can hear from experts like Jen and myself on different areas in health and what works, versus listening to some Instagram hype or storytelling, where's the science, right? So you just following those simple steps and, starting somewhere, writing it down and doing it. And I'm cheering you on from Palm Harbor, Florida.
That's so amazing. And so, to the women watching this right now, maybe you're exhausted, maybe you're overextended, maybe you're telling yourself you don't have time. This is your permission slip. We are granting, Deborah and I are granting you permission to put yourself in the calendar and take care of yourself, whatever that looks like for you. Find the one thing that you're going to commit to do for you. And if this is still challenging, my cheat sheet is, what would I do for someone I love? And I answer that, and then I say, okay, great, now it's time to do this for me. And that's a really good place to start, because we can only share love and pour if we have a full cup. Okay, Deborah, this has been amazing. How can people reach out to you if they would like to learn more?
Thank you so much, Jen. Yes, this has been fantastic. I've enjoyed this. You can reach out to me. My phone number is 941-720-4408. And my website is epigeneticscan.com. Epigeneticscan.com. Look forward to hearing from you. And thank you so much, Jen, for this.
Absolutely. If there was one thing you wanted to leave with our viewers today, based off of everything we've talked about, from recovery to empowerment, what would you like to share with them? What would you like to leave them with?
Well, we're living in a time where technology, science, and personal empowerment can really all come together, right? It's a beautiful time to be here. You don't have to wait for disease. You don't have to wait to be tired, sick, or broken down. Literally, I mean, you have the resources. Take advantage of them. Honor yourself. You matter. And just, if you don't believe it, I'm sure talk to somebody that is close to you, and they'll give you all the reasons why you are important and why, you are loved. Listen to them, because I know that helped me. And just keep going one step at a time.
There you go. You heard it here, folks. Keep going one step at a time. It is time to take care of yourself. We do have to take a brief break, but we will be back after these important messages. Welcome back to Vital Signs. If you're just tuning in, you're going to want to go to nowmedia.tv, click on shows, go to Vital Signs to catch the first half of today's episode. It has been completely epic, and we're going to shift gears a little bit. We often hear about how sleep impacts our energy or our mood, but what if it's also infecting our hearts? Today, we've got our resident expert, Dr. Yasir Sunbul, back with us to explore that powerful and often overlooked connection between sleep and heart health. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Okay, Dr. Sunbul, talk to us. Does poor sleep increase risk of heart disease?
Sure. I mean, it depends on what context you're putting it in, right? So, people that have sleep apnea, where they have a lot of snoring or actually stop breathing at night when they sleep, that has been shown to be a marker, or can, increase your risk of heart disease. Obviously, sleep in and of itself is very important, and it's not just for the heart, it's for everything, right? I mean, your body needs a time where it rests and it gets adequate, regeneration of cells and sleep. And, there's a lot of things that happen overnight in your digestion system and, just your circadian rhythm. It can cause sorts of, all sorts of hormonal imbalances, et cetera. And so sleep is very important, and it can, obviously lead to a lot of bad problems later on if you're really not getting enough sleep and enough rest. But from a heart standpoint, yeah, especially when people have sleep apnea, which is a very underdiagnosed and undertreated disease, I think. There's a lot of people that just don't realize it. And so, one of the symptoms they may have is that no matter how much sleep they get, they just always feel tired. And that could really be a sign of somebody having sleep apnea.
So let me ask you this, because I agree, a lot of people don't recognize that they have that, and we've seen that even in athletes where they have issues and didn't it was undiagnosed. But if someone's dealing with a sleep disorder, if maybe they are waking up and they're never rested, even though they're getting the hours, or they believe or suspect they have sleep apnea, or even are diagnosed with sleep apnea, what is the first step you recommend that they do so that they can get moving on this? Because it definitely leads to a whole host of other challenges.
Sure. I mean, so, one of the things I encounter quite often in my practice is people come to see me because they're short of breath. And sometimes a lot of people, obviously it's a alternative symptom to heart disease. So it can be a sign of people having a blockage, a valve problem, et cetera. So a lot of times sleep apnea is really a diagnosis of exclusion. But, part of the history that you take is you ask people, if they snore at night and if anybody witnesses them stop breathing in the middle of the night, or if no matter how much sleep they get, whether it's 8 hours, 10 hours, 5 hours, they still feel tired no matter what. And a lot of times just that part of the history can be a, red flag that somebody may have sleep apnea. And so the treatment for that is really, first of all, they need to get a sleep study. So what happens is they kind of get watched overnight. While they sleep, and this thing tracks, how much they're breathing, how much they're doing stuff, et cetera, whether they stop breathing, what's their sleep apnea level. And then based on that, there may be a recommendation for what's called a CPAP machine. So it's this machine that kind of blows air into your lungs while you sleep. And so sleep apnea is not necessarily a lung problem. It's really a problem of your tongue just kind of falling back into the middle of your throat and blocking your airway at some point. And so, if you wake up a lot in the middle of the night because of sleep, you may have sleep apnea. It's because your brain is waking up because I need oxygen now. Like I've cut out my oxygen level. And so that's always, the biggest sign. And so once they get the CPAP machine, if they wear it, a lot of times their symptoms resolve. They're not short of breath. They're getting restful sleep. They feel a lot better. I mean, my own brother has sleep apnea, and I could tell you from his quote was, "I've never felt better till after I got my CPAP machine."
Oh, I'm sure. And I've seen the same thing in sports medicine. So if you think you might be having this, the take home, folks, is if you're getting the right hours of sleep and you never feel rested, definitely look into this because it impacts so much, including your heart health. But let me ask you a more general question. I wanted to dive deep just because you mentioned it, and I agree with you. It's something that's l lesser known, is sleep apnea. But what are some of the biggest sleep mistakes that you see clinically, that directly impact people's cardiovascular health, maybe with your patients or whatnot who come in if they don't have, for example, sleep apnea?
Well, I mean, obviously, lack of sleep can lead to a lot of things, right? I mean, it just increased fatigue, chronic fatigue. You can throw your cortisol levels off, which can lead to weight gain, which can lead to shortness of breath, which can lead to other symptoms, can lead to swelling. And so all those things can affect the heart from a hormonal standpoint, just in the sense of, it increases the sheer stress on your body, just the lack of sleep in general.
And one of the things that we definitely don't want to do is increase our stress. We've got enough of that in our lifetime today. So for someone who's watching, maybe someone who wants to protect their heart, what are some of the most impactful changes they can make that could improve their sleep quality and maybe help them along their journey so that they can be more healthy overall and take some of that stress and strain off of their heart?
Sure. I mean, I think it's really important, just like anything else, that we factor in for time of the day in our lives. We should factor in time to sleep in our lives, right? And so I think a lot of us are like, well, a lot of people have the mentality, I'll sleep when I die, right? I mean, that's the mentality, but that's not really the right answer, because you really need to tell yourself, you know what? I really need to get, some people just don't need 8 hours of sleep, right? I mean, I think for some people, 5, 6 hours may be enough for them and they're okay. I mean, we're all different in that capacity. I myself can sleep maybe about 6 hours and I'm good for the day and I don't feel tired. Less than that, I probably do. More than that, sometimes I still feel even more tired. But I think that's really important to tell yourself, set a bedtime, and especially nowadays with the amount of electronics that we all use, right? We're all staring at our phones, our iPads, our computer screens, whatever else we're doing. It really kind of disrupts our circadian rhythm, and it disrupts our, shutting our brain down for a while so that we can sleep, So there's good things to do is, an hour before you want to sleep, it's a good time to just kind of decompress and just shut down and, let your mind just kind of slow down and be able to relax. Obviously, some people just need help sleeping, and so sleeping agents aren't a bad thing. There's a lot of over-the-counter stuff that people can use, whether it's Benadryl, whether it's a Tylenol PM, whether it's, ZzzQuil or any of these things that are not addictive, don't require a prescription, and don't really have a lot of adverse effects. But when you do take those things, you really need to plan that you're going to get a certain amount of sleep, because if you don't do that, let's just say you take it at midnight, knowing you're going to get up at 5 in the morning, well, you're going to wake up feeling really groggy because the effect is still there from the medicine. So I just think it's really important for people to factor in how much sleep they need and adjust their schedules to factor that into their schedule.
So I know people are thinking, oh, that's great, Doc, but I live a busy life. I've got kids, they're in sports, they're doing all the things. I have a job. You yourself, you're a busy individual, you're a physician, you've got patient care, which I know keeps you up at night. No healthcare professional under the sun doesn't think about it on their downtime. How do you balance all of those things in your life so you can get the sleep that you need and take care of you? Because quite frankly, if you're not healthy, you can't take care of your parent, your patients, you can't take care of your family and do all the other requirements. So how do you manage that in your life?
I mean, I follow what I say, right? So I try my best to make sure that at a certain time every night, I say I'm gonna go to bed. Let's say during the week, I say to myself, I'm going to bed at 10:30. That's my bedtime. So at 10:30, I'm zoned out. I'm ready to lay down and go to sleep. Sometimes, I just lay there until I fall asleep. Sometimes, whatever. But I set a time because I know myself that no matter what happens, I have kind of this internal alarm clock. I wake up at like 5 or 6 a.m. every day. And so I try to make sure that, I go to bed at a certain time so that I ensure myself adequate enough sleep, regardless of how busy my schedule is, regardless of what's going on in the day. Obviously, some days you're going to end up being up later. Some days I get called into work and that gets disrupted at night. But, those are off days and they're not every day. But on the days I can coordinate it, yeah, I make sure that I go to bed at a reasonable hour and, set myself a time limit.
And let me ask you, have you ever had a time or have you ever experienced this or what do you recommend? Because this is a question I get a lot. What happens when you just can't turn your brain off? Do you have any suggestions for those who, when they lay down, that's when their brain becomes active and is impacting? Have you ever experienced that or do you have any advice for people who might be watching who fall in that camp?
I experience that all the time. So that's not unusual, to go through your day at the end of the day and start thinking about things that you didn't have time to think about throughout the day or decided not to because you're busy doing other stuff. And in that situation, when I feel like that's going to be one of those nights, sometimes you kind of know if you're stressed before you go to sleep, that's really the time that where your brain is running at night when you try to lay down. And sometimes you just plan ahead that those nights you might take something to help you sleep to kind of take the edge off, and just kind of zone your brain out. And I've done that at times when I could, because take a Benadryl or, take a Tylenol PM or something and just say, let me zone myself out to fall asleep. And so that's the best you can do. Sometimes meditation before you go to bed, right? That's another thing. We've talked about, I'm a very spiritual person. I'm a Muslim, and so we pray. And sometimes when I feel like it's going to be one of those nights, I will stand and pray for, 10, 15 minutes before I go to bed, and just kind of ask God to, give me the peace of mind that I need. And so there's no right or wrong answer here. It's just whatever you can try that works for you that ends up helping you, that's what I would do.
Fantastic and sage advice. Remember, folks, that everything on this show is for educational purposes only. Please make sure you consult your healthcare practitioner before adding anything to your routine. But the moral of the story is sleep is your heart's recovery time. Protect it like you protect your diet or your workout schedule. It needs to be something that you honor. We do have to take a brief break, but we will be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Vital Signs. We are here with our resident expert in all things heart health and treatment, our favorite cardiologist, Dr. Sonbul. And heart disease is a top health concern, especially in America, but innovations are changing the game. So I wanted to lean in and ask you, what are some of the latest advancements in heart disease prevention and treatment? Like, what's coming down the pipes? What are you most excited about?
So, as far as, heart disease prevention, I mean, I think the biggest things that we've been working on has really been ways to target cholesterol treatment. So I'm sure, I don't know, people have heard of what's called lipo A, which is a kind of a marker of cholesterol that people have been trying to create drugs to target reducing that, because that's been shown to have an increased risk of heart disease as well. Other things, a lot of medicines that we're targeting, the bigger things, obviously, are things like heart failure. And, what are we doing for heart failure as far as medication-wise to try to improve heart function, have people's hearts function come back to normal, et cetera. There's been a lot of work on, the different receptors that modulate heart failure and medicines in that capacity. Even with transplant options, right? And with, artificial hearts. I mean, there was a recent thing at Baylor where they actually put the first artificial heart in a human being, and it's kind of a way of a people that have really bad heart failure, how do they bridge them to transplant or give them a way to get their life back, as a function from a functional standpoint, because their heart just doesn't work. So I think from a prevention standpoint, there's not a lot, let's say, on the horizon for it. Other than, treatment of cholesterol, treatment of blood pressure, medications that kind of help. And sometimes it's a combination of medicines that we've had that maybe works better together, than working individually alone. But I think a lot of the developments we see in cardiology in particular is in the device world and in the, how, what kind of devices, what kind of surgical techniques. If, like we talked about in the past, your heart is kind of like your house, right? It has architecture, plumbing, and electricity. And so what can we do from those three standpoints to improve patient outcomes, make procedures that were once complicated, like complete open heart surgeries, less invasive? How do we get people to transplant sooner? All sorts of things like that, I think, is where really the development and the future of cardiology is.
And let me ask this because a big buzzword, a big technology that's all over the media is artificial intelligence. And every day, we're hearing about all of these advances in AI. Is AI playing a role in earlier detection, prevention, or treatment in the cardiology space?
I can tell you from my standpoint, no, I have not used AI to improve anything other than if I want to do a research on something or ask it a question, et cetera. I mean, there's a lot of rumors. Even Bill Gates said that, doctors are going to be replaced by artificial intelligence at some point. And I really find that hard to believe. And not because I'm a doctor or I want to say that, I'm better than artificial intelligence, but more of the fact that I think there's a personal aspect to medicine that I don't think you can ever translate into artificial intelligence. It dawned on me the other day that artificial intelligence was around from Iron Man, right? The movie Iron Man. Jarvis was artificial, but I mean, he was not, it's a movie. It's not really real. And so if anybody's ever used artificial intelligence or ChatGPT, it's not that simple. You have to ask it specific questions and really redirect it sometimes to get to where you want to go, so that it proves the answers that you're looking for. So I think from a cardiology standpoint, or even a healthcare standpoint, I would really find it hard that artificial intelligence is going to replace the human aspect of medicine.
Yeah, I would tend to agree that I see it being used more in a research basis and to improve outcomes from that standpoint. But I believe it'll ultimately evolve and be used so that we can get back to being more human in medicine, which is why we went into it to begin with, most of us. So let me ask you, because one of the other things that keeps popping up online, social media, in the news is more personalized medicine. Do you see cardiology becoming more personalized as technology advances, whether on the prevention or the treatment standpoint?
The only thing I can think of as personalized medicine is what we call concierge medicine that exists nowadays. I think it does exist for cardiology and some specialties, but that's where you're kind of, almost like a private physician to a group of people, and it comes at a cost and et cetera. I'm not really sure that. I think technology is going to help improve communication between patients and their physicians, and you can see some of that now, where most offices have a patient portal. They can send a question, you can answer it back online, they can get up their lab results, et cetera. There's some telehealth, obviously, and everything now ever since COVID. So that was an advancement as far as being able to, especially for elderly patients that have a hard time getting into the office, or people who have elderly parents, or that they're trying to bring in a wheelchair to the office to see you once a year. That could be a struggle. So, that kind of advancement has already been there. But I think, the way technology is going to work is it's really going to advance communication between patients and their providers. And they're going to start to develop equipment that's going to make it easier for certain things to be communicated between the provider and the patient. So, right now we have these home blood pressure monitoring, services where they give the patient a blood pressure machine, and using Wi-Fi, it transmits all their blood pressures to a database, and that gets reported back to the physician, and they can adjust medical therapy based on that. So I just think it's going to be building on what we currently have and just making it more sophisticated moving forward.
And let me ask you about wearables, because wearables continue to be more and more advanced. And in addition to the blood pressure monitoring, do you see wearables evolving or developing, or is there any talk in your circles in the cardiology world of enhanced diagnostics or maybe detection earlier from wearables and the data that they provide to maybe early detect events like heart attacks or some of the other issues that you guys see in the office and in emergency?
Sure. I mean, definitely. So, if you were to break it down again into architecture, plumbing, and electricity. So let's talk about just electricity standpoint for wearables, because that's where it's mostly used, right? So we monitor people's EKG rhythms and so forth when they have heart rhythm abnormalities or palpitations or abnormal heart rhythms. We want to track it somehow. That's the best way we can track it. So I think there's a lot of people, obviously wearing smartwatches that all have this technology, and that's been helpful, I think, in allowing people to say, hey, my watch told me I have atrial fibrillation. And then you can look at the rhythm and decide. There's these at-home service things that you can buy, like on Amazon, called this Cardia monitor, where you put your fingers on it and it actually gives you an EKG tracing. And I've had patients come in with this thing. They feel this stuff at home. They decide to order this monitor, and they come in the office and they're like, look, watch this. And then they show it to me, and it's real. And so I think, wearables are going to become more important. Even when we send people out with Holter monitors or event monitors, we send them out with a wearable so that they can, track their heart rhythm. I think where other advancements that, I don't think people are aware of, but aren't really wearables, but they're implantables, right? So if you take, for example, heart failure, it's the number one DRG used by Medicare, and the number one reason we admit people to the hospital is heart failure exacerbation. So if anybody's ever had heart failure, and heart failure is a syndrome, which is it's compromised, it's composed of shortness of breath, swelling, anything where the heart doesn't pump effectively. So it's not so much that their heart has to be weak or their heart is normal. That's what the syndrome is. And so if you were to look at, for example, recent technology that came out, a thing called the CardioMEMS device. And what this device is, it's basically a sensor. And so we can implant it in a minimally invasive procedure, like using a going through your groin, kind of like we do an angiogram, but it's just a different technique. And what we do there is we put this little sensor that sits in between your heart and your lungs. And so by the time people get to the hospital with fluid overload and their volume overload and their short of breath, those patients by that point have been accumulating that fluid for several weeks. Okay. And so they're no longer, the pills that they take home are not effective, because if you imagine that fluid backs up not only into your lungs, but into your abdomen, into your bowel. And based on that, the pills don't get absorbed. And so one of the things we've been doing here, and I was actually the first person in Sugar Land to put one of these devices in the Fort Bend County area, is implanting this CardioMEMS device. And what this device does is you take it, you go home, and you lay on this pillow every night, and it transmits what your volume status is to a database. And then I look at that database every Monday and Friday, and I would call the patients that had it, and I would say, looks like you're retaining fluid because they're exceeding their goal that we set for them. And so I want you to take some extra water pills today, for the next several days. And so it's designed to actually reduce hospitalizations, and it's about 80% effective in reduction of hospitalizations for heart failure.
Wow,
So
that's really.
non-wearables, implantables are also things that we are, really using in cardiology that has made a huge difference.
And that is huge because now you've taken something and you've caught it a lot earlier and you've maybe mitigated a major event. That's phenomenal. We are at time, but how can people reach out to you if they'd like to learn more or if they're located in the area and are looking for a cardiologist?
Yeah, they can look us up online, social media, or we're all over the place.
Thank you so much for your time and your expertise, Dr. Sombol.
Anytime. Thank you.
Absolutely. And you, unfortunately, all good things do come to an end, including this show. But the good news is we'll be back same time, same station next week. So until then, get your sleep, take care of your heart health, and we'll see you next time.